This is Steve Maxer continuing the interview with Mr. Ben Van Etten on the 22nd of January, 2003, at approximately 3 o'clock Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Van Etten is in Alabama. Sir, why don't we go ahead and pick up with the discussion of your time with Air America. And if you would, just go ahead and describe some of the operations you recall most vividly, and also the personalities, the people with whom you worked in Laos and Thailand.
Okay. First of all, the type of missions I think we talked about before, there was for what I, at age 34 that I was flying, we had three main customers, which the missions would have been a 713 customer, which is a CIA type mission where we're probably going to be supporting whatever their teams are doing, resupply or troop transport. The other ones, USAID, was refugee support and villages taking food, rice mainly to areas and other food, and then transporting those people. And then that became a kind of an evacuation mission too at times when they wanted to move a whole village because the North Vietnamese were coming in to that area. They went ahead and moved the whole village further to the west to get out of the try to keep them out of harm's way. And the other customer was what we called the RO, Requirements Office, which had to do with really support for the Laotian Army, logistic support for the Laotian Army, whether it be ammo, food, or troop transport. I think we talked about a typical work week would be normally six days on the flight schedule, working out of a location in Laos. Again, H-34 has worked out of all the way from Banui side on the far north all the way down to Pak Se as far south, and then quite a few places in between. And you would work for that particular customer that was the air ops customer that was in that area, mm-hmm. And he would give you direction on what to what you're going to be doing and where you're going, whatever. Some areas we did a lot of flying, and other areas flying was limited. Of course, we were paid by the flight hour. We tried to get 70 hours a month minimum, and because you were guaranteed for that much money, and then so it behooved you to go ahead and try to, if you could, to get as much flight time as you could, as quickly as you could. They give you more time off toward the end of the month. But, they tried to divide the load, someday you didn't, so everybody didn't go to the same place every time. The missions were, we also, I think I talked about the green stamps before and the special missions, and which were kind of a, added things to what we'd a normal daily routine, and they were mainly the infill or exfill of a team, a mm-hmm. road watch team, or the, possibly the rescue of a downed airman, downed U.S. Air Force airman, mm-hmm. and generally that, or something that came up all of a sudden that was out of a real hot area that you had a pretty good chance of getting shot at during that mission.
Well, the special missions,
yeah.
I've also had, I think I've heard them referred to as special projects. What, as far as the rotary wing support that you would provide, was it almost exclusively infill, exfill, and SAR, or were there other types of missions that...
Well, the only ones that I became involved with were the infill, exfill, and occasional SARs. Mm-hmm. There could have been other special projects that I'm not aware of. I was aware of, but I really didn't get involved in what they did exactly. For example, the Twin Pack program, which I wasn't in, ran specials. I think what they were just inserting teams further north than we normally went. Even outside of Laos, but I don't know for sure on that one.
When you say outside of Laos, obviously you're talking about inside of either North Vietnam or China.
Yeah, affirmative, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Serious? No. But I really can't mm-hmm. Say or elaborate or say much about those because I didn't do those, and so I don't know exactly what they did. But special projects and special missions really were not the same thing. A special project was a special project that you might... one crew or one aircraft may remain on for a long time.
Okay.
A special mission, that's something that's more impromptu that you're going to have. It's you're going to do it one time, then it's over with.
Okay.
And that's really the only difference. And
now, for the special missions, did you have to sign any kind of security agreements for those?
No.
Okay.
No, just, in fact, I never signed any security agreement for anything, the whole, my whole tenure over there.
Well, okay.
And, contrary to what some people believe, you know, may say, but I never did anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know of anybody else that did either.
Okay.
Of the pilots, at least.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other pilots that you flew with, in the same areas with any kind of routine that you remember?
Yeah, I, actually, I flew, after I had been there for a couple of years, I flew with most of the younger pilots as I was kind of what you call a training captain also, and I would fly with them to try to get their initial training out of the way so they could be upgraded also to captains. Additionally, I flew with a lot of Thai co-pilots too because, whether they thought I could relate to them or something, I don't know, but I didn't mind flying with them. Some guys didn't want to fly with Thai pilots and Thai crews, but I didn't care. And so I flew with them, quite a few of them too. And,
were there any, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say we also flew solo quite a bit too, mm-hmm. you know, in that program.
Well, most of your missions were solo, weren't they?
Oh, probably half and half.
Okay.
Yeah. If you were working an exceptionally, one of the bad, what you consider the bad area, or if you're working 713 jobs, normally if you're working USAID or RO, you might fly solo because many times they're just going to be shuttling either ammo or rice and into relatively secure areas. But if you're going to do the combat assaults or SARs or special missions, of course you're going to have a dual captain on those missions. So I would say about probably half and half.
Okay. And were there any particular reasons why some of the pilots didn't want to fly with Thai co-pilots and crews?
Oh, I think that some of them were kind of concerned about their proficiency, which, when they first started, they weren't quite as proficient, but most of them got to be pretty pretty good at flying. That and the language barrier. They all spoke English, but not real well. But I don't know other than that. But that's just some guy's idea. They just didn't want to fool with a probably thinking they were maybe taking a chance or you know. I guess.
Okay. How about Lao crews, Lao pilots? Did you ever fly with Laotians?
No, not with I'm not aware of any of the. I didn't fly with any of the Lao pilots, any helicopter pilots. So. Just the Vietnamese, the Thais from the wrong country.
Well, did you fly with any Vietnamese as well?
Well, I see. Backing up, we were in my training days when I was a flight instructor. I had a lot of Vietnamese students as I flew with, and same with the Thais too. I was back in Camp Walters or Fort Walters. I usually carried at least one each class, one of the foreign students like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting question. How about, we're on the subject of foreign students that you were training in Fort Walters, were there other nations that were sending their soldiers, their airmen, to be trained?
Well, there were a few Israelis. actually, at Fort Rucker, there were a few Israelis. I flew with one of them. There were some, mainly just Thais and Vietnamese at Rucker, at Walters. I'm not aware of other. There were occasionally what you might call an exchange student, but we didn't have any very big programs to train other pilots other than Thais and Vietnamese. The Laos, I don't recall any Lao pilots in the States. We trained most of them over there. We had a program going on the side over there that it really wasn't Air America, but they used Air America aircraft and Air America facilities. But it was some U.S. Army instructor pilots that worked over there with the Laos pilots to give them training. They worked in Thailand with them. They were not in Laos. They were down in Udorn.
Okay.
In fact, one of the guys I knew prior to that in the Army, he was still in the Army when he was over there.
Okay. Do you recall the names of any of the American pilots that you flew with in Laos and Thailand?
Oh, yeah, sure. I flew with Sandy Sant, who unfortunately he's dead. I flew with Dick Theriault, and he's dead now. These guys have passed on. I flew with Leon Michaume, and he's passed on. I flew with Roger Cook, who just died yesterday, the day before yesterday.
Sir.
I don't I don't know if you heard of him or not.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And I flew with all of the young, a guy named Danny Kowalik and, a guy named Conley, who unfortunately he's dead. Yeah, so we're all here and we're gone. Because when I first got there, I flew with a lot of the older pilots so I could get my train. I flew with John Fodenberg. I flew with Mike Tirina. I flew with Pogo Hunter, who he's gone now. Fodenberg is too, as a matter of fact. I flew with Jerry McEntee, he's still around. And of course, Jerry was a training pilot, so I flew with him for my annual flight checks most of the time. A guy named Wayne Webb also. I flew with a lot of them. Let's see. I mentioned Mike Tirina. I flew with J.J. McCauley a little bit at first. Of course, Abadie. There's a few other guys I was with a lot that I don't remember if I actually flew with them. They flew in the same flight with me, Jerry Tolman and Tim Woosley. And, Tim's dead, too, unfortunately. John Ford, he's still around.
Mm-hmm. And, how about the customers? You knew them by code name.
Yeah, most of them by their call sign. Mm-hmm. I worked a lot with them on the RO side. There was an Army NCO by the name of Larry Martin, who later actually retired from the Army as a sergeant major years later. Last I heard from him, he was working for Vanel Corporation over in, if he's still working in Saudi or someplace over there. But I remember him pretty well because I worked with I worked with different loadmasters and the people, the air ops guys. The customers, a guy named Fred Cost was up at the Lompabong, and down in Pauxay was Jim Butler. And the guy at Savannah Cat was named, his call sign was Church Bell. I'm trying to think who his name was. I can't remember. He was a smoke jumper from either Idaho or Montana or something in his other life.
Mm-hmm.
Worked with, of course, Pop Buell when he was alive and his people for USAID up at 20, at Site 20. And then just a lot of the local guys that worked for the customer, that worked for the American customer, that were actually in charge of giving making sure my loads were right for wherever I was going, to make sure I had coordinates and signs and so on. I worked with a lot of them because I worked with Tony Pohl,
mm-hmm.
one time and quite a bit. In fact, he was. Colorful guy, at least.
Well, what do you remember about the customers in particular in terms of, anything? Tony Poe in particular, but also the other customers you supported.
Well, excuse me. Of course, Tony was kind of like a legend.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been there forever and since World War II days. The deal about the years, you probably heard the story, but
yes,
that was a true story. Mm-hmm. The way he could get, he had to, up where he was, the site was 118 Alderman. I can't remember the name of that village right off the hat, right up in north, northwestern Laos anyway. And to get his teams to go out and patrol further out, he gave them a bounty on ears. If they would kill an enemy soldier and they'd collect the ear and bring it in, and he gave them probably about a dollar, but he gave him a reward for it. And he would take those ears and put them in little plastic baggies and staple them around the ceiling of his hooch where he was up there and where he lived up there. And so they went clear around, but I guess that stopped after he went to some villages himself and saw a bunch of kids running around with no ears. So they were just snatching them off live people and
mm-hmm.
turning them in, so that I think that was the end of the year deal. But,
okay, so that, and I had heard that story from someone else, so
yes.
I guess that probably is true.
Yeah, okay, it was the same version?
So he was given the bounties, but he later discovered that they were actually the way it was told to me from someone else is it was someone who actually either turned in their own ear, or he had seen the person without one and asked them what happened.
Yeah.
And they explained, well, you know, I got some money for it.
Yeah, I got some money for it. That's about right. That's a, so they convinced the little kids in villages they don't need an ear anyway, so ripped off. So, yeah, that's true.
What did you think about the effectiveness, though, of some of his, I guess, his unorthodox paramilitary style?
Who, Tony?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just thought he was a warrior. I thought he was very dedicated. I thought he was trying to do the job the best he could up there with what he was working with. He loved the Laotian people and the local people, and practically won himself. You know, he'd been there for so long, and of course he married a Laotian lady. And she lived in New Dorn, but so he, you know, for quite a few years. The assumption is they're still married, I guess, wherever they are, in California or wherever they are now. Because I heard he'd made one of the Lao reunions recently or the last couple of years. So I think he's probably still around. But I didn't, I know that he was having trouble with the local Laotian commander for that district up there because he suspected him of dealing with drugs or opium. And Tony didn't like that. So I know they were kind of on the outs because of that, because of their opinion on, you know, his opinion was he should not be doing it, but mm-hmm. he did it anyway. But I, other than that, I mean, he's a guy trying to do a job.
Yes, sir.
And I admired him, and he was he was there for a cause.
Mm-hmm. And as you said already, he was there for the long term.
Yeah. He'd pretty well settled there. You know, that was his life.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the other case officers that you had worked with?
Well, that's what I'm trying to think. Of course, I think I even mentioned one of my stories there, but Jim Lewis, who unfortunately he's gone too, but I worked with him a little bit, or quite a bit. And he didn't have a good reputation of telling the whole truth about, you know, the bad guys. There's no use going forcing yourself to go in harm's way if you don't have to. You know, you can always figure out ways to fly the mission without going right over the guns.
Right.
But he gave me the idea that he didn't really care whether you went, you know, whether you got shot or not, or your aircraft took fire or not.
Hmm.
Just wanted to get the mission done.
How long had he been there? Do you know? How long did he spend there?
He hadn't been there very long. He was there for a couple of years, maybe three years or so. Now I don't know when he may have stayed all the way through the end. I don't know on that because I left in the end of '72, and of course they still went on for another year there in Laos. So before they moved down to Saigon to finish up down there, but I don't know when he left the area. What I'd heard that he got killed on a mission or in Africa or someplace else that they'd sent him.
Okay.
I'm not really sure. You know, the routine. You know, if you could figure it was like an 8-to-5 war for us, it kind of was in a way because. We returned with our helicopters used to the town that we staged out of. You'd fly the missions all day out in the maneuver area, out where things were going on. But then it was relatively safe back at the base camp.
Mm-hmm.
And then the same when you got off and got back home to Udo, of course, then you're back with your family and relaxed. And again, Thailand had you didn't want to go driving around at night out in the country. But on the other hand, I wasn't concerned really with driving during the daytime anywhere in Thailand.
Okay.
And, even though it was reported some areas where it could be communists or bandits, but that didn't really concern me.
Mm-hmm. Well, while you were flying out of villages or staging areas in Laos, who would provide security in those villages? Was it always just the local?
Yeah, just now, like in Luang Prabang or Banu Isar, mm-hmm. the towns, there's the local police, and that's about it.
Okay.
We didn't have anything special. We just kind of, of course, there weren't that many Air America crews in a town. There may be, you know, two guys, four, six, eight guys, maybe max, but or you know, one of the bigger ones like Poxy or Savannah Cat, you could have some fixed wing pilots staying there too, mm-hmm. and same with up country too, but up in the northern parts. But we never had, I never had any fear of going out at night. We'd go down to the bars or go down to the noodle stand or something and relax, you know, after dinner, and mm-hmm. And then walk back home and get up the next morning and go. Now, like I said, I never, and I'm not really aware of anybody else that had encountered any enemy type problems, you know, other than the normal problems you're going to have when you get drunk and raise hell and that type of stuff mm-hmm. with anybody.
Mm-hmm. What about the aircraft? Would you store them in a secure compound or?
No, they were left out at the airfield. Now there were, you know, a certain amount of soldiers at the airfields where we were. Mm-hmm. But quite frankly, I guess anybody could have walked into the aircraft and stuck a bomb on one or something if they thought about it. But you know, another thing about that Laotian conflict was that the enemy, at least the path at Lao, knew that when we were there to deliver, not only to help fight for the Royalists, but to deliver materials and food. Mm-hmm. And I think they figured they were going to get their share anyway, you know, when things like that were delivered out to the different areas, and especially early on. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think a lot of times they figured, well, just leave the helicopters alone because we're going to get some of that ourselves.
Well, that's interesting. Did you ever hear or even see perhaps some of that material being sold on the black market?
Well, I'm not even sure if it would be sold as much as it might have been an agreement that you know, if you leave my village alone, I'll go ahead and share some of the rights with you or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I had heard that, you know, mentioned before when I was, especially early on when I was first there. Now, later on, of course, when the NVA became more and more involved in really running the show on the communist side, well, then, you know, I doubt if there was any much collusion going on then, but mm-hmm. at that time. But with the Path of Lao, which, you know, a lot of times were just the brother-in-law or the cousin of whoever was there already.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't surprise me at all. Now, did you ever hear that that even the Russians gave them aviation support early on? I mean, talking about the very early 60s or late 50s.
No, I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, and I'm going to say Air Russia, but it was
right.
They had an aid program going there too. With fixed wing aircraft, I don't believe there are any helicopters. There could have been, but very early in the after the first coalition governments were set up there, and you know the path that allowed the neutralists and the royalists, the pilots would stage out of Incheon, for example,
mm-hmm.
and fly their various missions during the day, whether with Russia supporting the path that allowed and of course the American guys supporting the rest of them, and then at night they, you know, sometimes they get together and have a drink at the bar or something, just like it was, you know, put the airplanes to bed and go on in, and you know, for them the war was strictly during a daytime thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now I don't know anybody particularly that did that, but that's what I heard. Fixed wing, these are fixed wing guys. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware of any of the helicopters, you know, sharing space out there with the Russians, but they did have some fixed wing support.
Now, did you? I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just wondering if you ever ran into any on the streets? You
know, I never did. They were gone when I got there.
Okay.
That particular program was gone.
Okay. Any other foreign nationals?
Well, there were, I think they, what did they call it, the CIC, I think it was called the CIC. What it was a monitoring Poles, I think there were Poles, Canadians, and Indians.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was called the CIC, and we flew for them too. We supplied their aircraft. It was a white aircraft, different color than our own aircraft. And occasionally, I'd fly that aircraft.
Was this part of the International Control Commission?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
ICC. Okay.
So you did fly some of them around?
Yeah, occasionally.
Uh-huh.
We draw that mission because they used our. We supported their aircraft with maintenance and whatever, mm-hmm. and pilots too. At least the helicopters. I'm not sure about the fixed wing.
Mm-hmm. Now, would you fly in terms of the amount, the types of supplies you could carry in your aircraft? Well, did that include building supplies and things like that, or was it pretty much limited to food and ammunition?
No, it was sometimes for USAID we would take whatever they needed, including live animals.
Okay.
you've probably heard the story. And what we would do, he had a young water buffalo, of course, he would make sure it was pretty well tied up. You didn't want to, because they wouldn't kill those until they were ready to eat them,
mm-hmm.
Because obviously there's no refrigeration, so he didn't want to kill it ahead of time. So we would fly several times. I've flown live hogs and live buffalo out to an area where they're going to have a party or wanted. And then, of course, the pastures you pick up, they could have chickens with them and ducks and, other live animals. But and then, of course, we flew just, people a lot of times, the local folks, and especially the males up from the, they live in the higher country, and we bring them down into town. They'd hitch a ride. Somebody would say, okay, it's all right to jump on that aircraft and go to town.
Mm-hmm.
And especially up at Bonuisai, we had a high pad up there called the Victor Pad that we unfortunately had a crash on it, killed two pilots up there on that when I was there. Two guys that I knew, in fact, from the Army.
What had happened? What caused the crashes, do you
know? It was the pilots was Harvey Potter was the IP or the experienced pilot. And the other guy was named John Beardsley, who actually was a classmate of his in the Army, Army flight training, and he knew him in the Army. But he was a new hire to Air America, and he was up there training with him, and somehow John managed to. It was kind of a high pad. It was a kind of a rough pad, a lot of rocks and things on it. Managed to tip the aircraft over during landing or takeoff. On the pad, and it caught a fire. It caught on fire immediately, and the crew chief was able to kind of scramble away. He got some burns, but he was not seriously burned. But the two pilots, it fell on the right side, and the student pilot was on the right seat, and the instructor pilot, who was Harvey, was on the left seat. And all he really had to do to save his own life was just to go right out the window there on the left mm-hmm. side. But he stayed in the aircraft long enough to get John out and pull him out. And because they were in the fire a little bit longer, they both breathed it. And they actually lived. They were evacuated from there to Japan, some burn center up there for a hospital up there for a while. But mm-hmm. about a week, less than a week later, they both died because they'd inhaled the fire.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah, it was. It was too bad. But anyway, that was that mail pad or picture pad, mm-hmm. what we called it up at Long.
Mm-hmm. Were there any particular airfields that you liked to fly into or didn't, or others that you didn't care to?
Well,
the
only one I really didn't like at all was a place called 69 Alternate.
Okay.
And to me, that area was always bad. It mm-hmm. was over by, I don't know if you heard about the Chinese trail and road they were building up there or not.
Very little. Why don't you explain what you knew about it?
Okay. Up in the northwestern part of Laos, mm-hmm. Being, again, by Bonuisai, which was Lima 25, which was on really our most northwestern big airfield that we'd work out of, mm-hmm. with the RON at. And even actually Lima 5-4, well, in between that area, there was a large area that Laos kind of goes out to the west and actually borders Thailand, too.
Mm-hmm.
And 69 Alternate was right just about on the Thai border up in that area is where they worked. But the Chinese were building a road. It was like supposedly an aid project, but anybody that flew there was going to get shot at. That's where we had a C-123 shot down, in fact, that the crew were missing for. I heard recently that maybe they found some of them, but they were missing for many, many years, like the crew on that one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when, to transgress a little bit, that's when Jim Ryan, the chief pilot fixed wing, lost his foot up there looking for those guys. And
mm-hmm.
I was up there with the helicopter, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I followed him as much as I could. They took an airburst, and he lost one of his feet.
Yes,
and luckily, there were three guys on board. Another pilot could still fly the aircraft, and the other guy that was helping them throw, they were throwing leaflets out there to the villages, saying if you you know, offering a reward if anybody gave any information about that C-123. And he was able to put a tourniquet on Jim and save his life that way, mm-hmm. or help save his life, because he would have bled to death probably otherwise.
Yes, sir.
But anyway, the Chinese road was the only route from China to Thailand without going over any major mountains. It was kind of a nice low-level route. And that's why one reason they were interested in building that, I think, to, it would give them an access to that part of Thailand. But whether or not it ever got finished, I don't think so. But we had road watch teams on that one, too. We would take in and you know, count their trucks and count their, you know, take a inventory of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Was there a lot of traffic on the road?
I guess there was. I didn't. Now, when I first got there, we used to just fly right over it, going on up in from between, let's just say, Lima 5-4 and Banui side. But in later years, you didn't fly over that trail. You flew around the south end of it, mm-hmm. over 69 Alderton, and then on up. It kind of followed. It's kind of a valley, and there was a couple of rivers in there too,
mm-hmm.
and it kind of followed that. Of course, the Mekong River was still further. See, the from Luang Prabang, the Mekong River really goes east and west,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of places it's a common border between Thailand and Laos, and that area too.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns north again, and it's still pretty much the common border, in a lot of places anyway, and on up through what they call the Golden Triangle, right up there, you know, where Burma and Laos and Thailand come together up there. And then, of course, China. But anyway, that road was another thing that happened there is early in the war, the U.S. Air Force would bomb up in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, they were restricted by how far north they could go.
Was it because of the road?
No, it may have been partially. They just didn't want the Air Force that far up. They were afraid they were going to get involved with Chinese or maybe
mm-hmm.
get shot down in an area they didn't need to be shot down. Well, they didn't need to be shot down anyplace. So anyway, for whatever the political reasons were, they pulled them back in a little bit further south
mm-hmm.
in that area.
Well, you mentioned that previously you used to just fly over the road, but did that stop for some reason?
Because we started getting shot at every time we flew over, the anti-aircraft to shoot at you.
This was Chinese anti-aircraft?
Yeah, Chinese, that's right. A good reason not to fly over it.
What would they shoot at you, do you know?
What kind of weapon?
Mm-hmm.
Probably 23 millimeters or quad 12.7
mm-hmm.
50 calibers.
Did anybody ever get shot down?
Only one that got shot down was that C-123
mm-hmm.
that I, you know, one that was missing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only one I'm aware of that actually took hits from the road, but a lot of us were shot at.
Mm-hmm. Now, were there during your briefings, if you were flying in that area, was there good intelligence about what the Chinese were doing there?
Well, the only good intelligence we had, of course, was if another aircraft received fire, he would report where it came from. Now, we just flat avoided that area. There wasn't any reason to fly over that road from there on. And obvious what happened. The 123 got shot down the next day or the next couple of days after that. Jim Ryan's up there in a Vopar flying. This is a U-21,
mm-hmm.
and flying, and he got shot. He took a round, and luckily they were able to continue on, but mm-hmm. get back home. But when I say he took a round, it was some kind of an airburst.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been 37 millimeter, but I don't know whether they actually had them. But even a 23 is a pretty big round.
Right. Now, did you spend very much time transporting Laotian soldiers around and especially not necessarily conventional, like Royal Lao Army soldiers, but the unconventional.
Well, the mercenary types were first of all, a lot of them were Thais,
mm-hmm.
from Thailand, and the Thais were actually out of a lot. Most of them were out of actual units in Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
that were volunteered or put into that area. And I flew. My percentage of time, I would say I flew soldiers around probably 20% of the time, you know, all of my flights and everything, would just fly, you know, they'd be loaded up and fly soldiers with their, you know, with their guns and their packs and go on in. Now, the big missions were, you know, were, with Vang Pao, was a, well, they were joint missions with all of our Hueys and H-34s. I also flew missions with Air Force aircraft, U.S. Air Force ponies, they called them. They were, let's see, what I mean, I think they were they were about the same size as H-34, except they were a turbine engine. And they weren't CH-53s; they weren't that big. I think H-3s is what they were called. But anyway,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
They carry about 20 people, I think, in those things.
Were they black ponies?
Well, yeah, ponies is what they call them. Mm-hmm. They weren't, when they say black, they weren't really painted black. They were painted gray.
Okay.
But, yeah, ponies, we flew with them sometimes. You know, there's some, I can talk, relate some funny stories that I think are funny stories about when we flew with the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
They normally would stage out of a Udorn or NKP, Nakhon Phanom, NKP is, you know, that was a forward base for the Air Force there. We would go in there, Air America crews would go in there with a briefing, a joint brief with them, and, you know, prior to the mission. Now, the one mission I can recall pretty well was we landed there. I think we had three or four of our aircraft, and our flight leader was a guy named Tony Burns. I don't know if you ever heard of Tony Burns or not. He's still around. He lives up in Pennsylvania, but he was a senior guy on this particular group of all those pilots, so he was in charge of our flight. And we're sitting in this briefing room, and first of all, just to get in there, NKP, of course, is a secure camp. And, of course, we landed inside that. And then to walk into the briefing area, the CIC or whatever they called it, I mean, it was going through barbed wire and all kinds of stuff, you know, like it was really a big deal. And then we got into this area, and it was the Air America guys all kind of sat in the back of the room. Well, and then was all the pilots from the Air Force were up front, and then there were the briefers. And first of all, some lieutenant gets up and is going to give the weather brief, and he starts talking about the weather in the South China Sea and everything. And, you know, we're only going to go, the mission actually was to go right across the river, and there's a town called Tauket right there. And just over that, behind that, there was a place we called the Rooster Tail, which was kind of a hot area. And that's where we were going to infill a bunch of troops. I think we're going to shuttle them from Tauket up into the Rooster Tail, which is probably not more than 3, maybe 5 miles max, you know, after the pickup. So it wasn't, really a big deal, but it was a shuttle. We were going to continue to take them up there until they were out of, you know, until we got them all in there. So anyway, so the mission starts out. He starts giving the weather, you know, all over the world. And then the next thing they're talking about, I guess, general concept, enemy action and stuff like that. And then finally they get to the end, and we talk about loads and everything, and they end up, and this colonel that was up there briefing, he says, okay, Air America, you have any questions? And Tony is funny. Tony Burns, he gets up, he had a kind of a British accent, even though I don't know why he had that. He always smoked a pipe, and he gets up like a limey accent. He says, well, Colonel, I have one question. And he says, what's that, Captain? He says, where in the fuck are we going? See, they never did tell us where we're going. And everybody cracked up when he said that.
Did the briefer crack up, too?
Oh, yeah, the Air Force are cracked up. That
okay.
Because really, the guy, you know, they got us through this big briefer. They really never told us where the objective was. Other than it was out that direction, you know. Anyway, that was pretty good. That was classy.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I got flown with him. I flew with a guy named Chuck Brady a lot, too, when he was there. In fact, I wrote a story about him. He was my instructor when I got there, and then he quit for a while, and then he came back, was a new hire, so now he had to go through retraining, and I was his instructor.
In fact,
that was kind of... Unfortunately, he died. He smoked like a chimney, and he like if he got the big C later on, he's gone. It's like a lot of my friends that smoked all their life and paid for it.
That's right. What any other missions or incidents involved in the Air Force?
Yeah, I had another mission one time that went down near Autopoxay with the Air Force, and these guys were the ponies were out of I think out of Ubon or that area, somewhere another place in Thailand. And the support, the air support, were A1Es, or what they called them, their call sign was Hobo. Excuse me, Hobo down there. And we did the same thing. We had a brief. The brief went, the brief was actually on our side over in Laos down in Pak Sae by the customer down there. But we shuttled troops from the Pak Sae area back into a, not too far from there, back into an area where the enemy had pretty well taken over. It was near the Bulavans Plateau, but it wasn't up on the Bulavans. It was kind of down alongside it. And we did that. So we staged in another area, too. There's down there, you know, they've got the Lima sites all over, you know, the LS sites. Mm-hmm. Down there, there are PS sites, Pak Sae sites. It was the only difference. In that area, we had some of them were Lima sites, but a lot of them were called PS sites. And that was just another area of Laos, another core area that the CIA customers were down there and training these guys. And after they trained them, we would infill them into wherever they were, you know, whatever they were going to be doing. Mm-hmm. And this particular mission was Joint Air Force because we wanted to move a lot of people in a short time. And so in between the missions. Some of us would remain out in the area and kind of in an orbit in case we needed to go and pick up somebody. And then as we were orbiting the area, say at about 3,000 feet, the Air Force hobos would kind of make a large circle around us as our cover. And this one hobo was actually flying like kind of like in formation with me about, you know, like my wing and talking to me. And then he said, I remember him saying, well, I'm getting low on fuel. I'm going to need to go back and refuel, but I haven't expended any of my ordnance, so go ahead. And they had some kind of a target down there that they wanted to go ahead and put some ordnance on. So he just kind of dives from me, right down away from me, down maybe, and I'm watching him do all this, and he strafes and bombs this area, or actually puts rockets on it, and then I think he dropped a couple bombs on it, too. Several miles away from me, and then do these a climb right back up to my altitude, and then rejoin me.
Mm-hmm.
And just as he rejoined me, he was not more than I would say 300 or 400 meters from me is all. His aircraft exploded in a ball of fire, and it was just unreal. And now whether he took an airburst or whether it was something one of his own ordnance that he somehow got hung up or something went off, I don't know. But there wasn't anything left bigger than a foot.
Oh,
you know, yeah, it was just a ball of fire, a bunch of debris falling down, no parachute, no body, no nothing. You know, and I had a good visibility on all that. And, of course, King, or I'm not sure if it was King, but whoever the real high Air Force controller was, said, well, gee, Air America, run down and get, you know, swoop down and get the body or get the guy or rescue him. I said, hey, if I could see anybody, I would, but there wasn't anything left there at all. And that was a, you know, interesting story.
But you hadn't been taking any fire whatsoever?
Hadn't at all. And I'm just thinking, man, if that was an airburst that got him, they could have easily moved it out over and got me, too, but mm-hmm. they didn't. So, I don't know to this, you know, nobody knows for sure what caused it because there was no any more broadcasting from his radio or anything. It was blam. That was it. It was amazing because it was right next, you know, like I said, right at my altitude, right about few hundred meters out mm-hmm. away from me. And
was he carrying any ordnance that would have a time delayed fuse or
no, there wouldn't be any delayed fuse, but maybe there was something that might have got hung up, you know, a bomb, although I don't know if it, you know, a bomb has to hit something to go off, and
right.
and same with his 2.75 rockets, they've got to spin so long, you know, so many revolutions away from the aircraft to arm themselves, and so you know, I don't know, and because the assumption is he took some kind of an enemy round, you know. Mm-hmm. But
a single shot?
Well, I didn't see any other ones. You know, I don't know.
Right.
And he didn't mention either, you know, he didn't normally say, hey, I'm getting shot at, or mm-hmm. or I heard some shooting or something. And,
right.
But he didn't end up. It was just one of those things.
Very interesting. Very sad.
Yeah, it is sad. I wrote a story once about this was a long time ago, and they were talking about trying to whether or not they're going to recognize Vietnam again as a, you know, given recognition. And mm-hmm. I was in favor of that, and I wrote why. And part of that was, well, we've got so many MIAs, until they're all accounted for, we shouldn't recognize them. Well, my story was, and I use that as an example, I said, you know, there wasn't anything to recognize out of that poor fight. He was MIA there,
mm-hmm.
and because they never had got a body, but obviously there was nothing left to find.
Right.
And that's unfortunately the case of most of your MIAs, because most of them were airmen, you know, pilots.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get shot down at 600 knots, you know, wherever you are, there's not going to be much left unless you're just lucky
mm-hmm.
to parachute. And then, unfortunately, if you don't parachute right over Hanoi, Haiphong, or someplace where they can take care of you, you know, if you just go into the jungle, well, it's, you know, it's a survival thing out there. And even if you're captured, the enemy doesn't want to, you know, especially if you're wounded, they don't want to take care of you. You know, they've got a problem, less problem to take care of themselves. So, and that was kind of my story, was that, you know, there aren't any more MI. You know, there's no more bamboo cages someplace out there with, you know, with prisoners that they didn't release. And, you know, at the end of the peace talks, and we got our peace folks released from Hanoi, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they had to give us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was positive.
Well, do you recall about how many SAR missions you yourself participated in?
Oh, I was on at least a dozen or more missions. Now, I actually picked up four different occasions. I had actually picked up a downed airman
mm-hmm.
out there.
Were these all Air Force pilots?
All Air Force. And one time I took a guy and moved him to a safer area and let him out because the jollies were coming. They picked him up.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't want to leave him where he was. And
right.
Took him up to the top of this hill and left him up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's happened before with other pilots, too. They were just moving to a safer area.
Mm-hmm.
Let the jollies get their air medal and make their pickup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But... that would allow you also to jump in quickly, even if you were in the middle of a mission.
That's exactly right. You're right there. And time is of the essence, of mm-hmm. course, and stuff like that. I mean,
right.
if a guy's on the ground too long, he's going to get captured. If
right.
you know, you know, the another thing that's that was, you know, when I spoke before about the 1 year tour in Vietnam being too short, really. I mean, even though it was nice to get in and out, but, you know, by the time you're getting some pretty good experience and get to know your terrain and get to know your aircraft and everything, it's time to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Same with Laos. the Air Force tour, the guys that lived in Thailand that flew in Laos,
mm-hmm.
Or the Vietnam to Laos, were there for a short time, too. So they, a lot of them really not, except for the fact, you know, the Ravens, that's a different story. The guys that lived up there, you know,
mm-hmm.
they stayed for, some of them stayed for many years.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a different breed, those guys. But anyway, for the normal Air Force guy out of a UDORN or something, you know, that would be flying missions in Laos, when you go into one of their briefings, you know, you'll look at a map, and the map will have red marks on it where the enemy fire was. Well, the difference between their maps and Air America maps is that, you know, that gun would move, and we showed it moving. In other words, if it shot at you one place one day, and then you got a shot at another place another day, the assumption is that gun had moved, because, you know, they're on wheels anyway. And but the Air Force never bothered to do that. They just, and so after a couple of years, it was solid red. And I'd be nervous as heck flying in Laos, thinking the minute you crossed over the Mekong River, you're going to start getting shot at, and it's no man's land. Well, it's not really the case.
Mm-hmm.
Some areas were worse than others. I mean, there wasn't any area that was 100% safe all the time, other than, you know, the big towns. But the point was, there was no need to get that nervous. Now, we've had Air Force guys a couple occasions with their F-4s getting shot over Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Coming down across the Laos to get back home to UDORN and refused to bail out. I could saw one above me, you know, and I said, hey, go ahead, we've got a visual on you, go ahead and bail. And he's smoking, you know, go ahead and bail out. He's, oh, no, negative, I'm going to, you know, he's just afraid that wherever he goes in Laos, he's going to be dead meat.
Mm-hmm.
and you know, that would take a billion soldiers to cover that big of an area. And obviously, you don't want to be unfortunate enough to land right in the middle of an enemy concentration. But on the other hand, there's a lot of areas there that are, there weren't an enemy.
Right.
So, of course, that's why, by being there for so long, well, first of all, before you even started flying on your own, you know, as a captain, you had to know the terrain real well, especially where you could be working.
Mm-hmm.
But after a period of time, of course, you got to know it very well and got to know pretty much where the bad guys probably were or might go and so on. So you just try to avoid that.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Air Force method of tracking where anti-aircraft weapons were in place, it doesn't make much sense.
No, it doesn't. And particularly see along the Ho Chi Minh Trail with all of its mm-hmm. little tributaries, I could say, you know, they had a lot of little other roads. You know, we would bomb a road really bad, and they would, and before they were repairing it, they would go ahead and divert around another area, mm-hmm. you know, in some places. But anyway, that area, anywhere along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, there were guns at one mm-hmm. time because they're on wheels. Mm-hmm. But they're not guns everywhere. But that's, you know, if you'd look at their map, it was solid red the whole, from one end to the other of that trail. And other areas, you know, that up in Sam Nua province and areas where it was a heavy Palau area.
Mm-hmm.
And where the North Vietnamese operated out of, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of things we could have done, I think, the U.S. forces could have done out of Vietnam
mm-hmm.
into Laos that might have helped their cause a little bit more, because we didn't have enough in Laos. We didn't have enough folks to completely block the Ho Chi Minh Trail, for example. That would have been one of their, to me, it would have been one thing they could have done. You know, gone in with enough arms, enough folks to just block off an area, don't allow them to use it.
Mm-hmm.
But what we would do, we would bomb them, strafe them, and then leave. And of course, they just kept moving. They'd pull into their, they moved at night. They'd pull in during the day in the caves or in areas that were sheltered, and then move out the next day. I had some missions at times to go check on the trail. I had one customer, I'm trying to remember his name. His call sign was Greensleeves, but I'm trying to think. He was a big old, probably an ex-Marine, and he loved to take a tank mine, anti-tank mine, and we'd fly out there and land on the trail, and he'd bury it right there. Then the next day we'd go out and check and see if anybody hit it. And that was his big thing, you know, setting his traps out there and then going and checking them.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, there was another guy that liked to take a 55-gallon drum of fuel
mm-hmm.
and strap a grenade to, or tape a grenade to it, and then we'd fly over and you'd kick it out of the aircraft and, of course, pull the pin on the grenade. And then, you know, in other words, you're making your own napalm bombs.
And that this would occur over an enemy?
Yeah, we'd go over an area like it could be an enemy. For example, see, there were enemy occupants. A lot of those, what you call French forts, that were scattered all over Laos, most of them left over from the French and China days. Some of them were occupied by the enemy,
mm-hmm.
and especially up in the northern part. And cause I made the error one time of getting too close. I thought it was a friendly one. I came in. I was high because I wasn't sure. I wasn't going to let down. And boy, it lit up like a pinball machine.
Wow.
That was pretty high, so mm-hmm. just flew on out of it. But it was an area that probably maybe several months earlier might have been friendly.
Mm-hmm. What was the ceiling on that aircraft? What was the limit?
Oh, I wouldn't. Normally, we wouldn't fly much above 8,000 to 10,000 feet at the highest.
Okay. Could it go much higher if you had oxygen?
Yeah, it probably could, although the recip engines lose an awful lot of power as they climb up, and so it would have really been hurting for power.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you mentioned the Raven facts.
Yeah.
What do you remember most about them? Any particular facts come to mind?
Oh,
any particular pilots come to mind?
There was a guy named Jim Gallagher that I knew. I didn't really know him by name very much, just by, you know, their call, you know, Raven 2-1 or Raven so-and-so, you know, Raven 6 or Raven 10. That worked out, and they worked, see, they were based out of a Long Prabang, they were based out of 20 Alder, they were based out of Pak Say, Savannah Cat area, and probably out of Vientiane too, I'm not sure, but anyway. And they would return to their bases too, and you know, they'd work that area. And, of course, they were pretty gutsy. They get down there at treetop level just flying all around looking for targets. And then when they found one, of course, they would they would mark it and call in an airstrike on it. Did I mention the time that I was working on a special forces camp in southern Thailand and got shot at?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, this is a pretty good one. There was a camp down. I don't remember what the name of it was. It may have never had a name for sure, but it was real close to Laos, down across from Phong Sa and Kong Island, Kong Island is on the Mekong River, which is where the Mekong leaves Laos. Well, it's a common border between Laos and Thailand, and goes into Cambodia. And so it's right down in the very southern corner is where we were working with it. That camp was on the Thai side, but it was right near that area. And what they did at that camp, they would train. There was two or three Americans there was all. There was a master sergeant and a captain. And there might have been one other, but I can remember the two because when I used to work for them, they were there all the time. And what I would do was, they had teams that were working on the Laos side, and I would transport either the teams back and forth or supplies to them. And I was already told by my bosses, do not take the Americans into Laos, you know, period. And so, but they were always, this captain especially was always bugging me to give him a ride. And I'd been shut in. We weren't going more than like 5 miles across the Mekong into this area where they were camped on the other side. So one day he's been bugging me to go. I says, okay, you can go with me this time, but if you get shot, I'm just going to take your body and throw it in the Mekong and pretend like you were never with me because I'm not supposed to take you. He said, oh, no sweat.
Mm-hmm.
So we flew over there and flew the mission, did whatever, you know, dropped off or pick whatever we were supposed to drop off. We're on the way back, and I was on final approach into the compound in Thailand, and a guy, and right over an open field, a guy jumps out of a little hooch there with an AK, and I saw him plain as day, pointed right at me and let go with about a blast of 10 shots. And man, there was bullets flying all over my cockpit. I didn't get hit, but there was pieces of the honeycomb and mm-hmm. pieces of actually one of the bullets actually, after it ricocheted around there, ended up right on my shoulder. I picked it up. And anyway, immediately I sucked the aircraft back up high and got right over the spot, called the little compound we were just going to, and I said, hey, did you hear that? You know, get somebody out there and get him. And they didn't want to do that. And
what?
I said, so I said, well, at least let me register a mortar for you. So I got up high, and they had a four-deuce mortar, and they started shooting it out their way. And I'm trying to, you know, register it for them, put it on the target.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't hit their ass with a sack of wheat. So anyway, and I'm kind of pissed because I was a pretty close call, and nobody wants to run. It couldn't have been more than a kilometer from the compound there, maybe even closer.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, I got on the air, whatever a common frequency was, and I to the Air Force. I said, if you've got anybody returning with any ordnance, I have a target. And they said, Roger, there's a flight of two A1Es coming back from someplace that still has their ordnance with them. And I said, well, good. They came in and got a hold of me, and I told them. They came overhead, and I said, okay, it's that hooch right down in the middle of that field. So then they strafed it with bombs, CBUs, rockets. I mean, I'm telling you, when they got down, there was nothing left down there.
Uh-huh.
And finally, one of them says, okay, Air America, what was the enemy? I said, oh, it was one guy with an AK. And he shot at me. And they said, well, you're kind of vindictive, aren't you? I said, you're damn right. When they shoot at me, I take it very personal. But and I don't know whether we got him or not, because I was watching. He didn't go out, but it could have been. He probably had an underground escape area out of that.
Mm-hmm.
But when we landed, of course, the captain who was with us, he might have organized something more to go out there and take a look. But, yeah, I couldn't get the ties and the people there on the ground to go out.
And where in Thailand was this again?
This was over on the Thai side, across from Phong Sa. It was
okay.
the closest Thai base to there would have been Ubon.
Okay.
Base. It was a little south of that.
Okay.
Just off the Laotian of the river there on the Laotian border.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another day.
Mm-hmm. Well, how about other incidents where you were shot at and, you know, these were close calls?
Oh, there were a bunch of them. I sent you the story about Christmas Eve, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
that was.
But you can talk about that as well.
Well, okay. The the area I was going to work this particular day was, first of all, it was the 24th of December, 1970. Some dates you never forget, and that was one of them. Anyway, because that was really my first mission after I was released from the Burma in Tonglen there for a while. And it was going to be one of these missions where I was just going to shuttle stuff all day long out of a place called Mung Sui, which is a it was a Lao compound with an airstrip there, probably a 5,000-foot strip, pretty good-sized strip. And then it was right west of the Plain de Jars, and we had, at that time, we had outposts all around it, but we didn't control the Plain de Jars. At that particular point in time, the enemy had it. And so you don't fly over the PDJ. There was a lot of anti-aircraft there. If you could look at the picture of the PDJ, it was like a boneyard out there with lots of downed aircraft laying all over the place from over the years, you know. But anyway, so the procedure was you would take off from, in this case, Mung Sui. I was going to pick up the loads, take them out. They were going to get, and we had many compounds all the way around, outposts all the way around it, so I was going to resupply them. So I was flying solo that day because it was supposedly a piece of cake mission day, as long as I didn't get over the PDJ. And the flight mechanic with me was a guy named Charlie Brigham. He was a new guy, a guy I'd known in the Army, enlisted guy in the Army. And he had just come to work for Air America. And this was his first flight as a fully qualified crew chief. So he and I, along with a Laotian lieutenant, loaded up a bunch of, I think they were mortars, or I believe they were mortar rounds, in boxes right in the door of the aircraft. And so the idea was you don't want to spend very much time on the ground in that, or on that area, but so you come in and discharge your load, kick it off as quick as you can, and fly on out. So we flew over the area and circled overhead looking for the signal. And they came up with the proper signal out, and the lieutenant was on board talking on a Prick 77 radio, and to the ground guys, and he said, you know, he tells me through the crew chiefs. Of course, I'm up above, you know, H-34. I can't see him, but the flight mechanic Charlie Brigham told me. He said, yeah, he says it's okay, and I started circling on down to land, but I noticed that there were not a lot of women and kids on the on the pad. So that's usually they're there to watch the helicopter. So when you don't see that, you know that there could be some action that's been happening around there. So I told Charter this. I said, I'm going to keep the aircraft pretty light on the struts when I land. Go ahead and get the load out of it as quickly as you can, and then we're going to be out of there. So I hadn't any more than touched the ground, maybe a few seconds, and they shot a recoilless rifle at me, which, luckily for us, went off just short of the aircraft and then ricocheted up through it. And, of course, hit the aircraft, and I was sure Charlie must be dead. I couldn't see him from where I was sitting, and I took some shrapnel on my right leg. And so I grabbed all the power I could and figured, okay, if it flies, it flies. If it doesn't, it doesn't, because the next round will get us direct. And they usually don't miss with those things. We were fortunate. And took off and started climbing out and hoping he was okay. And I asked him, I said, you okay? And he says, yeah, I'm all right. But he said, I can see you're not. By that time, the blood's starting to run down the inside of the aircraft from my leg. And I said, well, as long as the aircraft will fly, we'll be okay to make it back to Mung Sui, you know, to get picked up, and they could haul me off to the hospital. And I made aid, and a Platus porter was right near there working there. And he said, okay, I've got a visual on you. I'll follow you on in to Mung Sui. And so I got in there, and Charlie, I jumped piggyback on his back, and he carried me, although I probably could have hobbled over to him, but carried me over to the porter and got in, and he took off with me for Udorn. The aircraft, the round itself, put 60-some holes right through the aircraft. In one side and right out the other. That's the power of those rounds. It was, an 82-millimeter would have.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, we were very fortunate. It wasn't a direct hit. It just hit short and sprayed the shrapnel up on us. But I guess there was nobody else. Charlie didn't take any hit. It went all around him.
Mm-hmm.
And I was only, I guess, the only person that took any, that got wounded for that. But anyway.
Was that the most serious wound you received?
Yeah, it was. It was, I never got any, that was the only time I really, you know, bled. Because I got shot in Vietnam, but
mm-hmm.
that was another time. But,
in Laos.
In Laos, that was
was the most serious injury you received.
Yeah, that was
You were really lucky.
Yeah, I was. Sure was. Very lucky. Could have been gone.
Because
that aircraft is full of abgas, 115, 145 octane. So a direct hit would have been quite a fire.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Now, could you, in the event of something hitting your fuel tank, did you have a quick dump capability? You could just basically dump your fuel? Or?
No, couldn't do that in that aircraft. It was all pretty much self-contained. And the other thing about back in those days, they didn't have the crash-worthy or explosion-worthy systems they do nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had a crash landing, same with Hueys were the same way. If you had a crash where you split the aircraft apart, well, you're going to probably have a fire because that tank's going to get apart,
mm-hmm.
come apart too.
Mm-hmm.
In modern days and right now, in fact, the fuel tanks and helicopters are all fixed so they break away and self-contain if there's any. And they also self-sealing.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. Did you have a self-sealing tank?
No, we didn't. But later on, because I'm being an old maintenance guy, I know all about those too.
Mm-hmm.
The way they work, they've got layers of rubber,
mm-hmm.
and in between that layers of rubber, there's a substance called butadiene. In case you're on Trivial Pursuit sometimes for helicopters. And the butadiene, when it mixes with fuel, if a round went through it, of course, it would cause it to fuel to get on. It expands 8 times its size.
Oh.
Real quick.
Okay.
And so anything up to a 50 caliber round, it'll pretty well plug that hole right up.
Wow.
Pretty good, yeah, right then. So that's a good deal.
Yes, sir.
And we didn't at that time. They weren't crash resistant or self sealing tanks like they have now.
Right. But if you did have a self sealing tank on one of those aircraft, with that fuel, would probably a round hitting it set it off anyway?
It could, yeah, because it's pretty volatile.
Right.
I mean, fuel has to, you've got to have vapors to get that explosion. And so if you want to say you've only got a half a tank of fuel,
mm-hmm.
so half of it's full of vapors, that'd be a better possibility. If you were completely full of fuel, then you might have a chance of not having a fire.
Okay.
But,
were you ever short of anything that you needed for those aircraft?
Oh, not really. Maintenance was generally real good, and we just operated what we had. You
mm-hmm.
know, if you can imagine flying that old aircraft, well, they weren't that old. It was old technology, but the aircraft, actually, the ones we had were pretty new ones right out of the Marine Corps.
Mm.
But anyway, with very limited navigational aids, or there weren't any nav facilities really in Laos to speak, there were a few beacons. But that was it, you know, if they were having to be turned on.
Mm-hmm.
And flying with those, you know, in the mountain, very, very mountainous terrain, weather, especially during the monsoons, was pretty skosh. Bad guys shooting at you,
mm-hmm.
trying to operate with the max loads, and then navigate. And you navigated by map. You had to be able to read a map.
Mm-hmm.
And it was reported that a lot of the maps were not really, really accurate. You know, they were pretty accurate, but not like they would be nowadays.
Right.
They were probably made by the French originally.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, you operated that way but that's all you had. So
mm-hmm.
in later years back in the military, and the stuff they have now is all, you know, GPS navigation and all kinds of automatic pilot stuff and everything. It was not that easy back then, and then plenty of power too.
Mm-hmm. But your navigation in Laos in particular, what was the biggest hindering factor? Was it weather, smoke, combination, or something else?
Probably weather was the worst thing.
Okay.
If the enemy, of course, you try to avoid them, you know, when you're coming in and out and going into areas, figuring, okay, the enemy are just over the hill, or the enemy are probably over here. You avoid that. A lot of the pads that we serviced, though, were real high, right on the tips of mountains right around there. Mm-hmm. That's where the families were stationed. So to land on those, we had to, in many cases, you couldn't set all the way down. You just put one, you'd lock the brakes and then just kind of ease it so one wheel was on the pad.
Mm-hmm.
So they could unload the stuff out of the cargo door, and then you just kind of slide right off and fly right down the side of the mountain to get out of there.
Mm-hmm. But all the while, you're still running. You're still.
Oh yeah!
You're hovering.
You're kind of hovering there. That's right. Mm-hmm. You just hold it up, and you have to. You know, the higher elevation ones, you've got to plan that you're gonna when you're on short final, or you know, just prior to landing, you're gonna be losing your power. So you got to make that approach to the ground and time it so that you don't hurt the aircraft any, because you'll be running out of power in a lot of them, and you know that.
Goodness.
Fly it that way.
Mm-hmm. What you mentioned that you qualified that generally maintenance was good. Were there any particular problems?
I didn't have much problems. I had one incident I can remember pretty vividly, and that's I was flying an aircraft that I could hear a clicking sound from the transmission area, and. And I mentioned it, I wrote it up, and I write up your faults, and I mentioned it to the to the chief pilot when I called in for our daily calls, or I called him and I said, you need to send a maintenance guy up here to look at this aircraft or do something with it. I was due to rotate out, and I was going to leave the aircraft up country and just get on a fixed wing and drive and fly home, and so I mentioned that there was something there that was. Something was wrong with that transmission. Shouldn't be making a noise like that. So I went up. I went home, and actually, I picked up another aircraft. I was out flying the next day again, and I came back up in that same area, and I look over, and here's that same aircraft I was flying the previous day with that maintenance problem, and it's flying. So I got with a pilot, and I said, "Hey, let me look in the logbook. I want to see what they did to fix that, whatever it was." And they hadn't done anything. And I kind of got a little upset about that. I raised hell with the maintenance guys and said, "Hey, I really did hear something." And I told the other pilot that was flying. I asked him, "Did you ever hear?" He said, "Yeah, I was hearing this thing. I didn't really pay that much attention to it." And I said, "Well, there's something wrong." And sure enough, that particular aircraft, there was something wrong. It was not getting. It had a bearing that was going on the transmission. But I guess they fixed it eventually. But. That was, one of the things that,
mm-hmm.
Years later, when I was a very senior Army aviator with a lot of experience, and I was a maintenance test pilot, and a young pilot would come with a problem, which, I wouldn't belittle him, but I would think to myself, well, he's just from inexperience, he doesn't know what he's hearing
mm-hmm.
or not hearing,
mm-hmm.
but, and of course, a typical. Corrective action was checked and found okay, which really that is a typical one of take it off your test flight and try to duplicate a problem that they said it had
mm-hmm.
and couldn't duplicate it. So,
hmm.
but and maybe back then the older maintenance guy might think that young guy doesn't know what he's hearing. So,
mm-hmm.
anyway.
But it was a bearing.
Yeah, it turned out to be some kind of a bearing problem.
Now. Would that have, if a bearing went out, would that be a catastrophic failure?
It could have been. It may not have been. It could have been. But, it was allowed to go long enough. Of course, you could even have a fire, if it gets hot enough.
Mm-hmm. It's just not something you want to mess with.
No, you want to change it, especially if you're flying.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't like you can just coast it to the side of the road and call for a tow truck.
Right. So. Now, were there any serious mechanical failures of any aircraft you flew?
No, well, I had an engine failure there one time.
Mm-hmm.
This is an interesting story, too.
Mm-hmm.
I was flying solo back from up country back toward Vientiane, and I got a call from some USAID workers that had our frequency, little handheld radio with our frequency, asking any Air America aircraft, could you come in and give us a ride back to Vientiane? We're at site so-and-so, it's USAID, it was a I think it was a dam project or some kind of a project they were working up there. And I called him. I said, yeah, okay, I'll come over and get you. And I would go right near there. So I picked him up, and then I flew back. I was flying solo, so there was nobody up front with me. The two guys I picked up were down below with my with the crew chief, the flight mechanic. And, in fact, his name was Rick Straba. He's still around. I think he lives in the Chicago area. And I see him occasionally at reunions, but it was going to be one of his last flights, or maybe his last flight. He was getting ready to go home. And so I flew on up at a real high altitude, up to 7,000 feet, I think it was, and then locked down. That aircraft has an automatic pilot, too. You just have to get it all set up. Then you can push the button. It'll hold you where you are, you know, your altitude and your heading and so on. And so I locked down, friction down all the controls, and had my feet kind of up on the up on the console, and reading a book, and Fat, Dumb, and Happy, as it was kind of flying, you know, heading home. It was homing in on the there was an ADF at Invention, and so I was all tuned in on that, and it was homing in on that. And all of a sudden, kaboom, bang, the engine quit on me. And when you talk about scrambling around up there at the cockpit to get the pitch down and get the, you know, in a helicopter. So anyway, I got it down, and we said Mayday, and started the auto rotation. Because I was 7,000 feet. You know, that's pretty high.
Gives some time to play there.
Yeah, it gives me plenty of time. And so I start making a big old circle as I'm auto rotating, looking down below me, and all there is solid jungle.
Mm.
It's just, you know, I made another revolution, and I just didn't see anywhere to land. I'm thinking, and that was, I think it was in 1969, and there had been several fatal accidents just prior to that, which were all attributed to pilot error.
Mm-hmm.
And the pilots died on them, and so they really couldn't defend themselves one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking right now, I said, shoot, here's one here. I've got an engine failure. It's not my fault.
Mm-mm.
And I've got a crash and burn probably in the jungle, and they're going to call it pilot error.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's going through my mind. And so part of my Mayday discussion was, well, by the way, the engine quit. You know, I'm auto rotating, and you know. Anyway, about my third revolution down,
mm-hmm.
I saw a little Buddha provided a neat little clearing. It was small, a little rice paddy clearing, but it was big enough to auto rotate down into.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started setting up for that. And the other thing that happened is that because I was up so high, letting down so quickly, the windows of the front window on the H-34 is made of glass, mm-hmm. not plexiglass, but actually glass, and it got all steamed up. You know, in the jungle, the heat we were descending down into caused the window to get all steamed. So I couldn't see out in front. So I'm looking out the side window with my head sticking out that turn, you know, and do my auto rotation into the landing area.
Mm-hmm.
And I can still recall as I had it made. I was on short final. I started a deceleration. And I remembered, shoot, there was one lone palm tree in that rice paddy area. And I'm thinking, man, that'd be something I hit. I made the area okay, but I hit the darn palm tree. But as it turned out, I didn't. It was to one side. But
mm-hmm.
That's what was in my mind. But, you know, during your deceleration, your final, you have no other, you know, there's no go around.
That's it.
But anyway, we no problem. We got in there and landed okay. And a helicopter came out later and picked us up.
How softly can you land one of those aircraft in an auto rotation?
With practice, real softly.
Okay.
Yeah. You just got to make it right. You only have one try. But,
right.
And what you do on H-34 is it's got a tail wheel, so you hit that first and kind of drag it along the ground, holding rear cyclic on it, so you dissipate all your forward airspeed, and then as it settles down, hopefully with very, very little forward roll on the main gear, then you cushion it in with your collecting pitch, and
okay.
You're there.
Okay. So when you landed here, another aircraft came out, picked you up.
Yeah.
What happened to your helicopter?
They came out the next day with maintenance and then changed the engine out.
Oh, so they brought a new engine out to the aircraft?
Yeah, brought another engine out. It swallowed a jug is what happened, a valve, I mean.
Wow.
You know, it was also kind of funny. I got back to Vinci, and of course, mm-hmm. Udorn is our base, our main base. So I called back to the chief pilot, He says, did you run out of gas? I said, no. Next thing he says, were you overloaded? I said, no. And, you know, not glad to hear you. Well, John.
Yeah, really?
Good, you know, good deal. I'm glad you made it okay. Okay, we'll see you tomorrow. So anyway.
Man.
Yeah, that was all that was on his way. That was Jerry McEntee. It was the acting chief pilot.
Uh-huh. Did you run out of fuel? Were you overloaded?
Yeah. Oh. See, we'd had several fatal accidents prior to that, and just that one year was a bad year, and they were attributed to pilot error.
In those respects, so, I mean, lack of fuel and overload.
No, I don't know anybody that ran out of fuel, but they could have been overloaded.
Yeah. So did you ever know of anybody running out of fuel?
No, I'm not. I don't know of anybody over there that ran out of fuel. You know, there's some dumb things done, but.
Well, not getting personal in terms of naming people, but what were some of the dumber things that you recall?
Oh, I can get personal. This is Larry Fraser. You know
okay.
Larry Fraser?
Yes, sir, I do. I interviewed him.
Okay, you know the story about him trying to throw the smoke grenade into Don Henthorne's house?
No. This is an interesting story.
Go ahead. Okay, and this is what he did. He tell you how he got fired from America?
Well, he mentioned that he got fired, and I think he did talk a little bit about it. But
yeah, well, this is how he got fired. He was a friend of ours who's named Don Henthorne, another guy. I flew with him quite a bit too. Mm-hmm. Had this house that he shared with some other guys, and they called it the Captain's Club.
Okay.
It was out by a golf course in Eudorne, and it was kind of like a party house. It was always something going on there, you know. And it was a good place to go out and drink, and you know. Anyway, so Larry's flying an H-34 solo one day, and he thinks he's going to swoop down close to Don's house and try to throw a smoke grenade out of the, you know, into his window in his house.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's getting down close and kind of loses a little bit of control of the aircraft and manages to clip a palm tree that's right there and into the landing gear and puts a bunch of leaves and something. Anyway, darn near crashes.
Mm-hmm.
And he flies it back to Eudorne, and of course there's still branches sitting in in the gear, and pretty hard to explain how that happened. And of course it came, you know, people two and two together, and anyway, he got fired. he stayed over there with another company for a while, but
mm-hmm.
You know, he's going to be one of the sponsors of the reunion in
Jacksonville. The Jacksonville reunion.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Larry Fraser.
Yeah.
His wife just passed away, unfortunately,
yes,
this year.
Yes, sir. Well, so because it was discovered that he was, I guess, engaging in some kind of
goofing off, yeah.
Yeah, reckless behavior.
Yeah.
They decided to terminate his employment.
Yeah, they terminated him. As far as I know, that's the only thing he ever did. But no, we had some drinking problems there, and they, you know, it's 12 hours between bottle and throttle. It's a, you know, standard rule.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you're drinking a lot, you know, sometimes 12 hours may not even be enough. But and for other guys, it probably wouldn't even matter. They could. But we had this one guy who finally got fired. His name was Robbie Robinson, good old pilot, Huey pilot, been there for a long time, and. But he'd get in the bar, and he'd get so drunk, he's, you know, his head would be on the bar. And there at our club, you know, right there in Eudorne. Well,
mm-hmm.
when we started having those accidents and other problems, the customer was getting a little bit more picky, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
And so our flight ops guy, and usually it was like Dick Ford, he's still alive, Dick's still around,
mm-hmm.
would come in and with the next day's schedule and make sure there wasn't anybody still drinking in the bar that prior evening. It was on the schedule the next day. And Robbie, and of course I never flew with him because he flew the Hueys and I was H-34s, but I'd heard that many times other pilot with him would strap him into the cockpit and they would just go, and he would wake up maybe after the first fuel load, and then he'd be all right, you know, from drinking all night.
Mm-hmm.
Because he had it pretty bad, but when he got fired, one of our vice presidents from Taipei was there, and he mentioned to something about him about, you know, maybe you ought to be, you know, going home or something like that, you know, instead of drinking. And Robbie, I guess, gave him some lip about something, and he was terminated. You know, like you know, I don't need to, or I can do what I want to do, or it's none of your business, or something like that. But anyway.
Oh boy.
Yeah, I got him out of there. We had a lot of funny incidents. I like to write a little bit of humor when I write, and there's
mm-hmm.
I've got several, you know, kind of in the humorous note. But in fact, I can send you those. And in fact, before we get off, I need to get your mailing address
because
I want to send you those
okay.
tapes when I find them, so you can get try to get them. I mean, the 8-millimeter boots.
Right, so we could digitize the 8-millimeter for you. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Like I said, I don't know what you're going to get, and I don't know. Mm-hmm. They may be the film may be so brittle that it won't even work anymore, but, you know, hopefully we can get something out of it.
Right.
But another funny story is there was a guy who's passed away to another good friend of mine named Dave Ankerberg. Have you ever heard of him?
No, sir, I haven't.
He's in the Ravens. He's mentioned in, sir, he's in the book, The Ravens. Mm-hmm. But Dave, another former Army pilot and a good friend of mine too. I knew him many years later. I mean, all the time. He went to Fort Worth, where I lived, and after he left there, and then he flew to the police department there for Fort Worth Police. He was their chief pilot, in fact, for like 20 years or longer. He finally died from lung cancer. But anyway, but Dave was a jokester. And he was always pulling practical jokes. He was single. And over there, he would get a lot of the wives together in the barn, and he'd have a raffle to be able to fly up, or no, he'd be signing up a list to fly up country with your husband.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he was absolutely,
right.
He's getting all these women to sign up, and they, you know, they'd buy that. And then,
mm-hmm.
and then, but one of the funniest stories about Dave was we had a new pilot over there named Francis Bennett. I'll never forget him, because I was also one of his training captains. And this guy Francis, according to rumor, had graded one of the highest Stanine test grades that they'd ever had. They were like a genius, but the guy was really weird, and it became evident when you flew with him. I flew with him up country, and a pre-landing check, for example, on any airplane, you've got certain things you read it off on a checklist. You know, pre-landing check, you know, gear down and locked. Mixture wrench or whatever, you know, trim on this or whatever, you know, whatever that particular aircraft needs,
mm-hmm.
is on the checklist. And so he made a little rhyme out of it, you know, and he would sing it to you. Did it, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know,
mm-hmm.
for every approach, which is, you know, I thought at first, well, that's kind of a good way to learn it, you know, and it kind of makes it fun. But then finally it kind of got on your nerves. He sang this damn song every time he landed. And that was part of it. So then the other thing was we got on the ground down there, and he and I were together flying out of Long Vong, and we were the only aircraft there on this particular couple of days we were up there. And so at night there was a place called the Tree Bar, which is an outside bar around a great big tree, which was kind of a neat. We used to stay at a hotel up there. In later years, Air America built their own hostel, which we stayed there. But anyway, Francis and I were there at that bar and having a drink and after work. And I'm trying to make comments. The guy was completely, I don't know, void of personality, I guess. He really couldn't talk to him about anything. And of course, I figured that, you know, he'd probably done a lot of flying in his life, so maybe he wants to talk about flying. But so we're talking. I said, Francis, you must be a... Let's see, what did he say? Oh, no. First of all, he didn't have any survival gear with him. And I said, Francis, you need to have a survival vest with a radio. He says, oh, no, I can't check out one of those because if I lose that radio, it's worth like $400, and I just can't afford to lose that. Well, you know, that was really pretty far-fetched. You know, I'd rather have the radio than anyway. And then I said, well, Francis, how do you plan to, if we go down someplace, how do you plan to survive
mm-hmm.
without any survival stuff with you? And he said, oh, I've got that figured out. And I said, oh, yeah, what's that? He said, oh, I'll go over to a river like the Mekong, and I'll get myself a reed to breathe and get under the water and breathe on that reed. And it followed all the way down to civilization, which I'm thinking, oh, man, what a, you know, what a loony tune. And he had hemorrhoids real bad, so he used to always be sticking these darn suppositories in his ass all the time. And on the H-34, you know, the pilots were up high, and one day he's got his bare ass sticking out of the window up there, putting a suppository in. Yeah. And that's all you can see, like a guy mooning the world out there. And here comes this fuel truck, this Laotian driving it. He's looking at him, he darn near drives into the aircraft because it's such a strange sight, you know. But anyway, the funny story with him and Ankerberg is this. He was up there training with Ankerberg, and they're in a, actually working on Lima 542, Alpha Bong, and on takeoff out of an area up there in the boonies. Dave says to Francis, hey, watch for ground fire for us. Well, okay, you can watch. What are you going to do? But anyway, he said that, and I'll be darned, on takeoff, they get shot at, and they take a bullet hole back in the pylon or someplace in the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're flying on out, and finally Dave says, you know, Francis, I'm kind of pissed at you. And Francis says, why? He says, well, you know, we took that round on your side of the aircraft, and I'm going to kind of have to blame you. You know, it's going to cost me $100 for the as a captain, $75 for you, and $50 for the flight mechanic, because, and Francis says, what do you mean? You know, he's always worried about money. Remember, he didn't want to,
mm-hmm.
What do you mean? He says, Dawson never told me anything about that. And he says, oh, yeah. He said, it's in the bullet hole file. And Francis says, what do you mean the bullet hole file? He says, well, you got to be cleared for that. Maybe you haven't been cleared for it. Maybe you haven't read it yet. It's a secret bullet hole file. He says, when you get back, you go in and see Captain Abadie, who was now the base manager,
mm-hmm.
says, and tell him you want to see the bullet hole file. So basically, we get back, and he goes up to, of course, Abadie's got a secretary out in front. He finally gets in to see Abadie, and Abadie says, yes, what do you need? And he says, well, I'd like to look at the secret bullet hole file. And Abadie looks at him like a truthful hour. What are you talking about? So he says, well, I was up flying with Captain Ankerberg. Well, that's all he had to say. He knew right away. He said, get out of here. But anyway, the guy was that gullible. One other thing about that same guy, when you're normally new there, you'll get a hotel room before you get a house or an apartment. So he was living in a hotel room. But rather than buy it by the month or buy it by the week or whatever, you know, it's to be a lot cheaper. Every time he flew, he would take all of his gear, which is like a suitcase full of stuff, and bring it back into the flight operations locker and put it in there and check completely out. And then go back, you know, rather than just living in one place for...
Mm-hmm.
And he thought he was saving money there, but he really wasn't, because
mm-hmm.
he was... Anyway, that's just... Anyway, he didn't last. He never checked out. He was gone after a few months.
Oh, really?
But anyway, he was...
What prevented him from checking out?
Being weird. Seriously, yeah.
Being weird.
Yeah. You know, you could be weird to be a pilot, but this guy was too weird to be. I mean, he was on another frequency. He was on, he was on VHF, and everybody else on UHF.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
that's bizarre.
Yeah, he was, but he was strange.
Well, you'd think just the suppository issue would be enough.
Yeah, that was funny. And he had a little rubber tire he kept with him to sit on, too, you know, all the time.
Oh, yeah, okay. Oh, for crying out loud.
Yeah, he was something else.
Well, what were some of the weirder guys that could make it through being checked out? Or what were their characteristics?
Colorful characters? There were a lot of, guys that like to drink and have a good time
mm-hmm.
and carry on. A guy named Ted Cash, he's still around.
Mm-hmm.
We were staying in Vientiane one time at a place called the Lang Zhang Hotel, which at that time was like the nicest hotel in Vientiane.
Mm-hmm.
And the Air America guys would stay up in like a various, we'd be about three or four to a room along, say, on the second floor. Well, Ted took his .38 pistol one time and went out there to the back, like a back porch on the upper floor of the hotel,
mm-hmm.
and shot at the lights above the police station, which was just down the block. Yeah. And next thing you know, that place was swarming with cops,
uh-huh.
and looking for whoever was shooting and everything else. And but I mean, I'm thinking, boy, that guy's crazy. You know, why would you take a chance like that? But there's a
unbelievable.
Yeah, I wrote a story about another guy named John Shine. this is quite a story too. He was solo with H-34, and I was solo up at Lima 2-5 by Bonnerisai. And the plan was, after our daily missions and everything, and there were a couple of fixed-wing pilots living there, too, at the hostel there, we would go down and have a beer together at this, and the little bar was just like a block away from the place we stayed, the house there. But as it turned out, I didn't get to RON there. Tony Poe was on that air, and he called right before my last mission and said he wanted me to come up there and RON at his location that night, and so, which I did. So I wasn't with John, so John goes down drinking. John carried a .357 pistol on his belt,
mm-hmm.
and he's sitting down there on the outside of this bar, drinking by himself, and had several drinks, I guess, and trying to get the bartender's attention to come out and get him another drink.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the bartender wasn't coming fast enough to suit him, so he took his pistol and shot it up in the air outside. Yeah, that's a pretty loud pistol too.
Mm-hmm.
And man, immediately there's police there and all the little and the police come over to him and tell him that they want his pistol and everything, and he wasn't going to give it to him. And he starts walking back up the street toward where our house is. He's a big guy, too. At that time, he was probably 240 and 6'6", you know, big guy. And of course, here's the little Lao cops. You're probably all like 5'2" or 100 pounds. But they all had carbines. They had guns, you know. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to tell him to stop and then to turn over his weapon. Well, he's not going to do it. He walks back to the house. And I don't know whether he threatened him at all or with a gun or anything, but he managed to keep on going. They couldn't stop him. Mm-hmm. And he got into the house, and the other pilots were asleep in there. And he hollers at the door and says, "Hey, get your guns. Get out here." Well, nobody's going to move. And meanwhile, the cops all kind of got a line right across the street in the ditch, and they're all lined up there looking, you know, with their guns pointed toward the house. And John goes inside, gets an M16, brings it out, and along with his pistol, he cocks his pistol, sets it up on the railing on the front porch there, and then kind of crouches behind the post there with the M16 toward the policeman. And there's one policeman out still trying to talk to him. And then somehow John reaches around kind of behind his back for his pistol, and it goes off. And it hits him. He hits himself right in the back. And luckily, the air back in there down, and he lived okay. In fact, I saw him at one of our recent reunions. I saw him in Las Vegas, in fact. But he was gone then. I don't think he ever came back. I think he either got fired or, of course, he was hurt pretty bad. But
he's lucky they didn't open fire. They
could open fire in that old wooden house they were in. They could open fire right into that thing.
But you
know, because they couldn't understand what he was talking about, other than he was big and intimidating, and had a gun, took a couple guns, but that was just a dumb move. But anyway.
Were most of the silly things like that happened, was alcohol typically involved?
Probably, yeah, in most cases. There was this guy, Ted Cash, I talked about.
Mm-hmm.
He had a wife. He has a wife named Kathy who back in those days was a kind of a party gal herself, and she used to, you know, the Air Force guys that were stationed over, like in Udorn in Thailand, you know, unaccompanied, of course, a lot of them had girlfriends there, and they would get these party suits up, which is actually a flight suit with all kinds of stuff on it, that they would give to these gals as they were at a party. Well, Kathy also had a party suit, and I don't know whether Ted got it for her or whether she bought it, but anyway, she had one, and she used to wear it around, and like she was like a party girl, but of course she wasn't Thai, so obviously she could attract attention of the American GIs over there because there aren't very many round eyes, as we call them, girls like American gals. So whether or not she had a boyfriend or not, I don't know, but Ted thought she did. And so one night there's a hotel up in Udorn called the Sharon Hotel, which was a nice hotel. It was like about 10 stories and had a swimming pool, and it was a new hotel. And there was a restaurant that a lot of us went to in that hotel. And Ted and Kathy are walking out of the hotel one night, and apparently an Air Force guy that he thought was seeing Kathy met him at the door. And Ted was an ex-Marine, pretty tough-looking guy. And he went ahead and punched him right through the door, right through the glass door of the hotel there. Obviously, it wasn't a real heavy glass door, but it pushed him through it.
Mm-hmm.
Just blap. Anyway.
So, did you ever discover whether this really was?
I don't know. You know, everybody suspected that she was probably running around, but I don't know. But anyway, another guy over there that he was also dead. I'm afraid his name was Albert Menzel. You ever hear of his name?
No, sir.
Now, Albert had one of these Austin Princess cars. You know what that is? Like a Rolls Royce.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And it was neat because when you drive in around, people would think you were the queen or the king of Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
To ride in the back seat of that, and he'd ride around town. Well, the town of Udorn, which is pretty much dirt roads, had these circles, you know, like they do over in Europe, you know, these traffic circles.
Mm-hmm.
And the Samlas are little pedal vehicles that they, like a little pedicab, you know, where the Samlaw driver takes people for rides in them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the Samlaw was in front of his Austin Princess one night, and Elmer had a drinking problem, too. He's all tanked, and the Samlaw wouldn't get out of the way, so he started pushing it with his Austin.
Oh, no.
And the guy's going 20 miles an hour going along. That was a lot of funny things, a lot of good times,
mm-hmm.
a lot of good trips. I don't know really what else to tell you about Air America. Other
right.
than,
well, let's see here. Well, this will end the interview with Mr. Ben Van Etten on the 22nd of January.